How much of the Buddha, how much of the Dharma, how much of the Sangha? All right, so today I'm going to talk about the two golden rules of Bodhisattva practice. Sometimes I don't think I go here too often. But occasionally I think, you know, I can go ahead and be preachy. I mean, that's what, you know, like ministers do, you know, like we have a Judeo-Christian, most of us are familiar with the Judeo-Christian tradition, and you go and you get a sermon and the priest is telling you should, you know, act with love and you should be generous and you should, you know, come on. So in that spirit, I guess I can remind you all what kind of bodhisattvas you should be. So if you listen at all to my podcast, you'll recognize that this is taken out of something I've been working on recently, which I'm calling at this point crisis Buddhism, because as I think you're aware, whether you agree with me or not, that I am convinced that we are facing a climate and ecological emergency, that we're facing climate breakdown, and that our next decade is going to be an extremely challenging time, and that we are going to really need our practice. We're going to need each other. And we're going to need to be strong. And so I'm kind of trying to come up with a formulation. I mean, obviously, it's something I've thought about maybe my whole practice life, but certainly over the last, like, 5 years or so, you know, like, concern about the environment and practice, but how do you bring it together? And how do you, I don't know, it, like, so what I've come up with is, which I'm not going to talk about at length today, but it's kind of just a background for these two golden rules of Bodhisattva practice. So the way that I'm picturing it is that there's, you know, if you want to practice crisis Buddhism, if you want to amp up your practice and try to respond to what's going on, that there'd be three aspects to practice. And one is bearing witness, is stepping outside of our comfort zone to expose ourselves to the suffering in the world. You know, there's many ways to do that. The news and kind of the course that we took here, Awakening to Whiteness, a ways back, and, you know, movies and documentaries. And there's many different ways to expose ourselves to what's happening in the world. And two is taking action, doing something, finding something. And there are many obstacles to this. And so that's part of what I'm going to be exploring in my formulation of crisis Buddhism. But part of what I want to emphasize in that is that not just taking action because we should, like for the sake of others, which, you know, we should, but also that it is, I guess, you know, to quote Dogen, like we think that doing that will benefit others and not ourselves, but that's never actually the case. Like, actually, we get just as much benefit, just as much growth. There's surprising benefits to actually taking action. So anyway, talking about that. But then also the third one is taking care. So that's taking care of ourselves and our responsibilities so that our bodhisattva practice is sustainable, that we have to do that. And for myself, you know, these are things that I have been doing myself lately, and I notice that when I conceive of it this way, and I am doing something, some taking action, which I'm calling, like, you know, it's taking action when you get out of the house, you interact with other people. It's for the sake of others, like, you know, really going to do something that, even if it's not addressing every problem and it's not an earth-shattering thing, somehow I feel more okay about taking care. Like before, there was just kind of a sense of kind of tension and stress and guilt and cognitive dissonance as I took care of my life because I was just kind of ignoring everything else. So now it feels like when I do that balance and I recognize, no, we have to have some time of stillness. We have to have some joy. We have to maintain our relationships. We have to have times which, you know, people have pointed out, like there are times when we come to the Zendo and we don't think about the fact that the world's falling apart. We need that sometimes. So, you know, so we do need to take care. So I, you know, I feel like sometimes if we think of this as a balance, then we can really be a little more wholehearted and simple about taking care as well. Well, kind of overarching the whole thing, I made these two golden rules of bodhisattva practice. So the first one's probably not going to surprise you, but that doesn't mean it is easy. So the two golden rules are always be motivated by goodwill or love. Use whichever word you like. Always be motivated by love is the first way that I thought to phrase it, and in a way it points toward our deeper aspiration, but I also think it points toward a certain warmth and saintly level of concern that isn't I don't know that it's entirely necessary. I think if we can replace ill will with just kind of an impersonal goodwill toward it in certain cases of just, you know, wishing for somebody in an impersonal way to be free from suffering, I think in a way that's enough. So always be motivated by goodwill. And the second one is extend your sphere of care and responsibility as far as possible. So get to that one. So this is where I feel like a Christian preacher. I always need to be motivated by love. And this means toward others and towards ourselves. That no matter what is going on, no matter who we are dealing with, this means setting aside harshness, rejection, a sense of superiority or a sense of inferiority. This means, you know, discerning or judging perhaps somebody's behavior as being unskillful or harmful or whatever, but not rejecting the person. No matter our views or who we're dealing with, aiming to interact with people respectfully and skillfully, sincerely concerned for the well-being of all involved, taking responsibility for our own feelings and reactions of anger, judgmentalism, hatred, whatever. I mean, these things are going to arise. So especially if we're facing challenging times, especially if we're trying to practice crisis Buddhism, or we're bearing witness, we're trying to take action in the world, we're going to encounter things that we wish were otherwise. We're going to encounter difficult people, opposition, resistance, whatever. And, you know, naturally, anger, frustration, judgment, all that kind of stuff is going to arise. So this is about, you know, recognizing those as being our reactions, and then practicing with them. And including ourselves in this whole circle of compassion and goodwill. So, you know, in terms of Buddhism, this is based in part in metta practice. So metta is loving kindness or goodwill, and it's the first of the four Brahmaviharas or divine abidings. So the idea is that these are prerequisites for practice. That if you're not based in these attitudes, your practice is going to be hampered. So this goodwill, you know, I think many of us are familiar with metta practice, but it's, you know, calling someone to mind and saying, may you be free from fear and anxiety. May you be at ease. May you be happy. And to really feel that as we say it. And we start with beings for whom it is easy to feel that. You know, friends and loved ones, or maybe even just pets or something like that. You know, start with something that, you know, just you can just totally sincerely, without any conditions, you know, wish that. And then we work on extending that and turning it toward people, eventually, you know, ourselves as well. And for each of us, ourself falls somewhere on the spectrum between it's easy to do that or it's incredible, like sometimes that's the hardest person for whom to feel real goodwill. So including ourselves in there. And the idea really is to be able to extend that to anyone, to, you know, our worst enemy, to the most terrible, harmful beings that have ever lived. And part of the argument for doing that is that anger and hatred hurt us, not them. So I said when you're trying to encourage yourself to feel metta, there's all kinds of recommendations for that. So there's indirectly, that's an acknowledgement that this can be really, really hard. But one of the things you do is you imagine the negative effects of harboring ill will. And one of those is picking up a hot coal to throw at someone. It's like, okay, well, it might hurt them, but, you know, it's definitely hurt you. And so this is a purifying spiritual practice when we can extend it even toward people that we feel resentment toward. It's freeing our own heart. So we practice love, another translation of metta, no matter what, no matter who, which is very, very challenging. But, so we do this for our own moral welfare, but also because it's the only approach that actually works to change the minds and hearts of others. If we no matter how noble our aspirations, if we resort to using judgment and shame, we will fail. And I think, you know, you look around our country and you look around the world, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing this division. I think I'm right. I think my side is right. We have the moral upper hand. But we're not convincing the opposing side. We're not doing a good job of that at all. We're completely alienating and infuriating the other side. We hate the other side, and they hate us. So now we're in a mess. So as the Buddha taught in the Dhammapada, he abused me, he attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those carrying on like this, hatred does not end. She abused me, attacked me, defeated me, robbed me. For those not carrying on like this, hatred ends. Hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So sometimes that's translated as by love alone does it end. But, you know, in a way, it's however you want to say, it's the end of ill will. It's the end of that hatred dropping in some way. And then, of course, there's the redemptive quality of love or goodwill. So this is from a sermon by Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. called Loving Your Enemies, when he was talking about that teaching of Jesus. And so he talks about, for a while, about how you do that. And then he says, but it's also important to consider why we should do that. So he gave three reasons, and the first reason echoes the Buddha's. Hate only increases the amount of hate in the world. The second is that hate distorts the personality of the hater. So what we were getting at earlier. And then his third reason, I'll read from his sermon. Now there's a final reason I think that Jesus says, love your enemies. It is this. That love has within it a redemptive power. If you hate your enemies, you have no way to redeem and to transform your enemies. But if you love your enemies, you will discover that at the very root of love is the power of redemption. You just keep loving people and keep loving them, even though they're mistreating you. Oh, they react in many ways in the beginning. They react with bitterness, because they're mad that you love them like that. They react with guilt feelings, and sometimes they'll hate you a little more at that transition period, but just keep loving them. And by the power of your love, they will break down under the load. There's something about love that builds up and is creative. There is something about hate that tears down and is destructive. So these are the messages from Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama, Gandhi, I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh. These are people who have faced much more violence and horror and whatever than any of us have. And yet they stick like this. They don't, like... Well, you know, love certain people, but once they get to, you know, to be really bad, then obviously that goes out the window. So this may seem impossible to actually do, but I think it's important to remember that this isn't necessarily a warm and fuzzy feeling. And it doesn't mean that we accept what people are doing. So Martin Luther King continues. He says, and you can use different kinds of language, but for him he's saying like is a sentimental something, an affectionate something. There are a lot of people I find it difficult to like. I don't like what they do to me. I don't like what they say about me and other people. I don't like their attitudes. I don't like some of the things they are doing. I don't like them. But Jesus says, love them. And love is greater than like. Love is understanding, redemptive goodwill for all. So, like I said, just a little sermon-like reminder to hold this aspiration. I mean, it's very... It's incredibly tempting to set this aside when we're dealing with the real world. Just forget our practice entirely. So before I go on to the second area, I figured I'd just open it up and I guess throw out there the sincere question. Do you agree we should practice this? And also, but then also, how do we actually do it? I mean, in our daily lives, as we encounter something or someone, and that ill will arises, you know, how do we apply this practice? If there's anybody out there who's like, yeah, I think there's a limit to this. It should not apply to everybody. I mean, please feel free to...
I like that you mentioned keep.com, because I remember reading something like his dad was like very physically abusive to him. And he's said in writing in the past that the way he looks at his family, or his dad is by that sense he's a big boy. The mental model he holds in his head is his dad is a little boy, and he has compassion for the experiences that make him act the way he did, rather than try to hold the mental model of his own daughter. Also, I don't know if anybody's read the book All About Love by Bell Hooks. Mm-hmm. It's all about that. It's like a whole book of how I...
Cool.
She calls it a love epic. The idea of approaching everything that you do.
Well, the only way I can do it, and I'm not talking about the big things because I'm not there yet, but just people that I deal with every day that tend to make me a little crazy and critical, it works really well, is to, I just use gratitude. Because if everybody was nice to me all the time, I wouldn't have any opportunity to learn to let go and to practice compassion when it's not easy. I mean, if it was always easy, where would my practice be? So when I find someone really getting to me, then I stop, and in my mind, I thank them for giving me the opportunity to practice letting go, because that's really helpful to me. And somebody posted something the other day that had a whole list of those. Grateful for illness, grateful for this, grateful for that. And I actually copied it because that's the only way I seem to be able to do it, is just to be grateful for that opportunity to practice letting go of all of that.
This idea of being able to generate goodwill really invites the question of what are the barriers to that, and how do we actually practice that? So this is for me that I kind of reverse engineer into getting to this place of really being sincerely able to approach all beings with the spirit of goodwill. So I feel like it really taps into our core practices of working with our reactivity, working with, for me, working with the ability to drop the self and see clearly. When I can really see someone, see where maybe their hatred or their mean speech or whatever they're doing that's like having, I'm reacting to, or is unkind or whatever, we've seen so much. Being able to take a pause and just see clearly. And I aspire to that. I mean, there are moments when that's possible, moments when there's reactivity, and then I kind of remember my intention, which is to have this open heart, this capacity for clear seeing. So I feel like that's directly taps into the Zazen practice of being able to fortify the ability to do that.
I recently forgave someone that I have always struggled to even acknowledge that I had a grudge against. Mm-hmm. And the starting place for me was to allow my hurt feelings to be very, very real. Not swat them away or push them away. Let them be fully present. And then to understand that if that person could see in my skull and see where I am, they would have been utterly horrified. And also, because I knew this person, reactive, defensive, sharp tongue. But all of that would have been in service of their own horror. And that is impossible to carry forward.
So a friend recently is having a difficult time. And I sent an email. This is a difficult person having a difficult time. And I sent an email to her, and she didn't respond. And so then I got concerned, and I stopped by her apartment. She lives at the same place I live. And I said, how are you? I've been worried about you. And she said, what? We're fine. And she, anyway, she was very abrupt with me. And why would something be wrong? I'm fine. And it went on that. She did that a couple of times over several different things. And then I left. And a day later, she sent an email, a fairly lengthy email about what was really wrong and what was bothering her, and saying, let's get together for tea at some point when things settle down. And my response was no response. I didn't say, yeah, that sounds great. I didn't do anything. And I thought, one more time, why do I reach out to her? But I didn't want to say, yeah, that's great, no problem, because I didn't want to get, anyway, I don't know if I was being open-hearted by not responding, not particularly, I suppose, but at least I wasn't being reactive. Mm-hmm. I was being truthful and doing nothing.
Well, I mean,
that brings up the whole other question of like appropriate boundaries and taking care of ourselves.
Yeah,
yeah.
Being honest by not taking anything.
Yeah, I mean, we have to include ourselves in this whole, you know, circle of compassion and goodwill. I don't know, it's like our practice never, it doesn't give us easy answers. You know, basically it's just saying, just it's this continuous process. You just have to examine every single action, every single thing you say, every single day. Open question, you know, am I keeping the precepts? Am I fulfilling my aspiration? Am I letting myself, you know, be obstructed from goodwill, through self-attachment? And usually, I really love this, I'm sure, I don't know where it originated, but I know I can trace it as far back to Roshi Kennett, Kyogen and Gyoko's teacher. He said, every act partakes of a Buddha and a devil act. So, I mean, in a sense, everything that we do, it's never 100% pure. There's always a little bit of selfishness or detachment or delusion in there. But I know that's strangely comforting as well, that, like, you know, because we might look and say, you know, we did our best, but then we see there's a flaw in there, and it's like, well, that doesn't nullify the good. For myself, I like to imagine a person, whether it's somebody that I know or just somebody out there who is doing something that I don't agree with. I just kind of imagine being in their house with them and just kind of watching them just do mundane daily things, and, you know, seeing what they eat for breakfast and seeing them interact with their pets or whatever. I don't know. There's a way that you can see this kind of common humanity in people, no matter how obnoxious they are. When the, you know, it's very difficult to feel sympathy and goodwill for somebody who's getting in your face, or, you know, is being really defensive, or is being, you know, which is how people tend to react when they're suffering, or they're scared, or they're whatever. They're going to become even less likable. So I don't know. I just try to imagine kind of stripping that away and catching them at a moment that I would just realize, like, they're a person too. And also, you know, one of the recommended methods for cultivating metta is to, this seems kind of weird, but it is kind of to imagine how they're suffering. So that you kind of, you get to goodwill through compassion. Like compassion is recognizing someone else's suffering. And for me, that helps when somebody, particularly when I'm dealing with somebody who, you know, maybe like our president, that does not, you know, shows none of that sincere vulnerability and just seems like blustery and strong and doesn't give a crap and whatever, that's very, you know, it looks, the suffering is not obvious there. It's much easier to feel this for somebody who, like, you know, is honest about what's going on for them or their insecurities or their struggles or whatever, then it's, oh, okay, you know, I can understand why they were rude to me because they got a lot going on. But a lot of times people hide that, you know, and they try to seem really strong. So we have to kind of get get a little more imaginative and creative and imagine what's going on behind the scenes. I think that's one of the things that our term student program is really useful for. It's usually not that extreme, but in the sense that, you know, when we get together and this program that we have once or twice a year, where a small, you know, 6 to 10 people or so go through this 3-month program. We make vows of training and stuff like that. But on the first retreat, we tell each other our life stories, like 10, 12 minutes worth of that, and then people ask questions. And for some people, that's a very daunting thing. Not everybody is, like, you know, extroverted and wants people to know their stuff. But one of the things in being able to, I mean, we're really giving each other a gift when we do that, because you end up realizing everybody has their shit. Everybody. And it's so, you know, people who you think, like, oh, she's really got it together, I wish I could, you know, like, but then you realize, no, everybody has struggled, everybody has their fears and doubts, and you realize, oh. And then it's easier to extend that to people who aren't showing it. And you know, no, they have their stuff. They have their stuff too.
That was helpful. Mm-hmm. It allowed me to think something I never been able to think at all, but I really do often think that I hate Trump. And I don't think I should, and so then that's sort of a double whammy, because then I'm scolding myself for doing it. But just as you were presenting that last part, I realized that one of the things I read, probably on Facebook, was an analysis that an analysis of Trump since the acquittal of his impeachment, and that he is acting paranoid. And I never, and that made a lot of sense to me just now, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me when I was reading it, but sort of the idea that he's structuring his whole world to not be in that vulnerable place. And so that was helpful. It's the closest I've gotten with that individual, but it was close to that.
Yeah. Contemplating, you know, how to not only how to practice this, like, within our own hearts, which is of course where it starts and isn't always easy, but contemplating how to bring it more out into the world. Very fascinating, daunting question. You know, that in a way you can, it's easy to look at the, you know, dialogue in our country and go, oh, dear, this is not working. But how do you change it? How do you, how do we do things differently? Yeah, and well, yeah, and it makes me think about, you know, the conversations that we engage in, and how can we be honest and discuss things with our friends and loved ones and stuff, but try to practice right speech to some extent, you know, like owning our reactions instead of saying, you know, that person is. Like, you know, when I contemplate people who are doing such and such, you know, it really makes me angry and I don't understand why they're doing it. But that's a lot different than, like, those people. That's just an idea that sprang into my mind. Other thoughts? Can you imagine a better world? Yeah.
Really, I've been trying to come in a situation where there's a irritating person or some situation that's getting me upset with another person, as I kind of try to stop and think about finding one time in my life where I acted like that or felt that way, or like that I would, you know, maybe I make other people feel the way that that person's making me feel. And I can usually find something from my past, and that really is helpful too. Turn to goodwill.
Well, and you know, presumably from your own experience, when you did these unskillful things, that you were trying, you were doing your best. It was a misunderstanding or something like that. So then you can kind of. That's a good one.
The chant we do at the beginning of the chants for forgive me for things that I have done. I find that really gives you humility, you know, because you think, I haven't done anything. It's all been done to me.
Yeah.
And so then as we chant that, I think it took me a while to not think this is so Catholic, you know.
my sins, I have sinned.
But it's ended up we repeat it, I think, 3 times.
Yeah.
So I think it's a good place to put yourself.
I just a bit about the rewards of taking action. On one of the rewards I did not anticipate. Were all the opportunities for humility. Because, you know, in your personal life, you know, you choose your friends and whatever, so you can kind of set that up the way you like it. And then, you know, I like to think that I'm pretty open to feedback here, and I certainly have gotten feedback from people, but I'm still the founder and the teacher, and, you know, I speak and people listen and, you know. But in my climate activism groups, I'm nobody. Like, so, you know, I'm just one person, and I'm just trying to go in there and be heard, and people are triggering me and people are giving me feedback about what I've done wrong. And, you know, so I have much more material for that. You know, karma verse. Now, you know, because I previously, like, I know there's something back there that I've done, but, you know, I can't really think of it. But now it's much more fresh. And I think that is as long as we're not completely demoralized by it, it can really like, to take it a little further, I'm imagining most of us in this room have a set of opinions about what is good and just in the world, what would be good, what goodness and justice would look like. And we strongly believe that, and we believe we are right. I know I do. And I have been doing more reading and study and having to consider, like, the people that I perceive as being on the opposite side of issues from me believe exactly the same. And actually, the criticisms that we, or I shouldn't say we, because I shouldn't make assumptions, the criticisms that my progressive political leaning groups level at conservative, you know, right-leaning folks, they use the exact same terms. I might say the opposite side is corrupt and driven by financial interests and elitist or power hungry or something, or ignorant or in denial, or like they level the exact same criticisms back at us. And of course I think, well, they're just wrong. But I think it's very interesting to start deconstructing this. And I'm actually reading a book by Ken Wilber right now called Trump in a Post-Truth World. And in it, he really criticizes the what he has a different name for these different movements through time, but he calls it like the Green Movement, like since the 60s, kind of the progressive and equality-minded and whatever. And he really points out how, to some extent, we are responsible for the situation that we're in, I mean, at least partly. And it's very humbling at a different level. Like, it's humbling, you know, I'm getting these personal interactions in my everyday life to get humble about my own daily behavior, but then this is humbling in a bigger sense of like shaking my worldview and saying, you know, maybe I'm not as pure and right as I think, and maybe there are things that I really don't see, and valid criticisms of the way that I think the world should go. And from a Buddhist point of view, this is only good. This is only, I mean, it seems like, well, what's going to happen if your worldview gets shaken and taken apart? But from the Buddhist point of view, it says, now you're equipped. Now you're better equipped to move forward and act. Because holding on to some kind of view and agenda is not where the strength comes from. So I don't know, that was a bit of a digression, but any last few comments? Obviously, we didn't get on to the second golden rule, so we just have more material for the future. Right. Oh, right. Formal end to the Dharma talk. Hold on. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. you all for coming.